water, cool water. Old Dan and I, with throats burned dry and souls that cry for water, cool, clear water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and it's waiting there for you and me? The nights are cool and I'm a fool. Each star's a pool of water, cool water. But with the dawn I'll wake and yawn and carry on to water, water, cool, clear water, water, water. Keep a moving, Dan. You listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. And he spreads the burning sands with water, water. Dan, can you see that big green tree where the water's running free and he's waiting there for you and me?
And that was Buster Scruggs with Cool Water. You're listening to 90.1 FM KZFR, people-powered community radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. My name is Ron Topi, and this is your North State Water Report. The opinions voiced on this program do not necessarily represent the views or opinions of KZFR, its staff, board of directors, underwriters, or volunteers. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Friends of the Arts, your state local partner with the California Arts Council. Since 2001, Friends of the Arts has been creating economic opportunity by producing and supporting events and publishing a bi-monthly arts and culture newsletter. To stay in the know or have your event listed, visit friendsof.art. And by Tires Plus, complete auto repair. The technicians at Tires Plus provide year-round services and maintenance for your vehicle, including scheduled maintenance, oil changes, AC and cooling systems, powder coating, and engine repair, along with Cooper, Michelin, and all types of ag tires. Located at 624 Broadway Street, Tires Plus Complete Auto Repair can be reached at 530-342-8338, at tirespluschico.com, and on Facebook. So, welcome to this month's Water Report. On tonight's show, I'll be talking with wildlife biologist Lindsay Wood, and Lindsay's going to come on a little later in the show and talk about the Feather River Canyon, and there was a train derailment up there recently, and some coal spilled off into the river, and Lindsay's done some research on that. And I'm also going to be speaking with Jeff Obser from Groundwater for Butte for a quick update on the Tuscan Water District. And while I get my first guest on the phone, I'm going to play a poem by Rudy Francisco, and it's called When the Water is Gone.
I have a fistful of afternoon, and I'm asking the summer if it will always be this glorious. I remember taking a deep breath, trying to get as much July into my lungs as humanly possible, thinking maybe I'd be able to convince it that 31 days just isn't enough. In my neighborhood, owning a slip and slide made you a royal family. In my neighborhood, we'd fill up our super soakers and shoot each other for hours, and if you didn't have one, you were just a target. In my neighborhood. In my neighborhood. We'd run through the sprinklers like someone who wasn't the boss of us said that we couldn't. Back then, the water just seemed endless. Like it didn't have limits and corners and edges. Like no matter where we were, if we called out for water, it would just come running. When I was a kid, dragons and droughts were two things I read about in books but never thought I'd actually have to deal with. I'm born and raised in California, and here our models and our rivers look like they're both on the same diet. Throughout the years, I've watched both get smaller, and now I can see their ribs when they exhale. In California, our freeways are decorated with signs that ask us to be careful about how we use the water. They hang like an eviction notice from the environment, and I wonder how long it will take the planet to tell us we can't live here and the locks are changed. I wonder how long it'll be before my shower becomes a relic, before my sink tries to change occupations, before the knobs on my faucet become roulette wheels, before my hands rain dance around the spout, hoping a drop will spill from its neck. I wonder if the next generation will know water the same way I did. The way it runs through the fingers, the way it wrinkles the hands, cools the skin, the way it freezes, flakes, and kisses the ground on the cheek. I wonder if my grandkids will ever throw a penny in a fountain and hear it splash. Thank you.
And that was Rudy Francisco with When the Water is Gone. And I have on the line with me now Jeff Obser from the group Groundwater for Butte. Jeff, you there?
I'm here.
All right. Great. Tuscan Water District. It's been on a lot of people's minds in this area for a long time. And
well, I'm glad
they recently had a. Yeah, they recently had a. Well, you know, there's been a lot of talk. There's been a lot of talk about it. I know I've talked about it on the show, and some of the other news and information programs have done shows on it as well. And you know, there was a vote. There was a vote a few months back, and so why don't you, you know, for listeners that might not fully understand what this is all about, maybe give a quick primer on what the Tuscan Water District is and. And, you know, where it's at now in its creation.
Okay, well, it's the Tuscan Water District was proposed in about 2017. And it was passed into existence on December 5th. They had a mail-in election. It's going to be the second biggest water district in the state. It is really quite huge.
Wow.
And it covers all of the land west and south of Chico, encompassing Durham, but Durham voters are cut out of it, and it goes right up to the Green Line and the western boundaries of Chico, and was crafted so that most of the people dependent on the groundwater would not be troubling its evolution by being able to vote on anything it does. And this caught my attention and alarmed the heck out of me, because I'm dependent on a domestic well in this area west of Chico, and I got involved and became the one person really willing to be the public face of a grassroots group called Groundwater for Butte. Why the only person willing to do it? Well, I just decided it was time to take a stand for democracy, even if it hurt. And that hasn't hurt so far, but I'm not dependent on the ag industry for my income. Other people we're involved with are, and they really have been sort of, you know, hanging back from some of our activities. Like, we had a couple of public events, we screened a film. Anyway, we made as much noise as we could about this last fall to try and move the needle on the vote. But unfortunately, it was a landowner-only election, which is an interesting California innovation.
Landowner-only election, so only people within the boundaries of that district that own land got a ballot.
Well, it's worse than that. It's the votes were apportioned based on how much land you own. So one vote per dollar of assessed value of land,
right,
and that
right.
does not include your house. So this, from the get-go, this was crafted to empower the largest landowners to make a determination on whether to have this new layer of government and how to run it, and when, what its activities will be. And I thought that was crazy, as to somebody who has just a home and a small patch of land, to have no representation in this. And I'm not the only one who felt that way by any means, but the whole way that the district was pursued from the beginning was very obviously and explicitly designed to do an end run around the voter and around even the public even really knowing about it. I got a ballot in my mail of September of 2022, and I hit the roof. I said, "This is crazy. This is not an election. This is an insult to my intelligence. You're telling me I have three votes because I have 3 acres. Well, the Mormon Church's international land buying arm had over 12,000 votes on that basis. Some people in our group, I'd like to think we could credit ourselves with having shut down that first election based on procedural problems. The county canceled it on the day votes were going to be counted, and we said, "Oh my goodness!" And they have already acknowledged that they have not done their homework legally on what they're trying to do with this thing. So then it lumbered its way through another year of, you know, being rubber stamped by the Local Area Formation Commission, rubber stamped by the Board of Supervisors, all with plausible deniability by the key figures who have been pushing this thing for years to be able to say, "Oh, it's the farmers really want this." No. This is something that has been cooked up in order to get the future of the groundwater here firmly in the control of a very narrow band of interest, and outside of even the attention of the city of Chico, the people of Chico depending on that same aquifer. My feeling about it now that it's been established, but because that first election was shut down, they couldn't ask for the property tax assessment on the same ballot. That would have been illegal. You need a 2/3 majority of votes to pass a property tax assessment. So per the terms of the first election, they got to have a second one, and that's probably going to happen in 2025, because they have a good year to just get ready for that. And I don't really know
that's to actually initiate a tax to help fund
because it doesn't have any funding. It has lots of debt. It's a lot of money, private money, voluntarily, just trying to get this thing off the ground.
Right.
So that will have to be paid back. And who's going to pay it back? Well, everybody who owns land in the district. But the problem is that second election will be the same. It will be based on land, on the value of land owned will determine how much influence your vote has. So we know already from the outcome of the first election that it's unlikely that we could prevail in the second one either, even on the basis of 2/3 of the dollars needing to vote in favor of, you know, of a property tax assessment.
So a few months ago, there was, you know, landowners within that boundary, the district's boundary, got a ballot and voted whether to even form this district, correct?
Yes. And the non-voters were the majority. Voter participation was fairly low.
Mm-hmm.
I can walk you through some of the numbers. I have them in front of me.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was like 77%.
Yeah, 77.95% yes, versus 22.05% no. And that's based on, you know, value of land owned. That's not how many people.
Right.
So
right.
We looked very carefully. Our data people looked carefully through. Non-voters were, in terms of if you just measure it by how many parcels got ballots or how many parcel representatives, 1,557 parcels voted and 1,578 parcels did not vote. We crunched them down to, you know, how many of those parcels are owned by one owner or one firm. When you shrink them down to try and account for those parcels in terms of people, there were 937 voters and there were 1,246 non-voters.
Wow.
So then you're really getting into some numbers of you know, what does this election really mean? Well, participation, I'll move on to participation by land value. 300, by land value, the voters were in the majority. The $369 million worth of land voted, and $262 million worth of land did not show up to vote. So,
wow.
I mean, I'm looking at my pie charts, and it's kind of absurd, but in terms of...
A lot of people just didn't send their ballot in?
Yeah. Yeah, and even some people who petitioned for the water district didn't send their ballots in. Which is curious. I think maybe somewhere along the way, some people might have just decided that they don't really care about this anymore, or they were persuaded that it's not a good idea. And we're going to put forth whatever effort we can to keep on persuading people that this is not a necessary thing. We all want agriculture to thrive and survive here. It's nothing personal. A lot of the growers who are under tremendous financial stress right now. The nut market is just in the crapper right now.
Yeah,
they're not able to break even. I don't want to see this area, you know, plowed under for subdivisions myself. I want them to be happy and thrive and make money and have enough water to stay in place. But this water district privileging the largest landowners, which are corporations, it just sets up a mechanism to have the whole area just become another soulless corporate zone.
So now that the people within that district have voted yes to the formation of this district, it's actually an official entity, right? But it's not any kind of government entity, right? It's not under the county, as far as like Butte County isn't going to run this district. Who's going to run the district, and can people actually vote for the people that run the district, or how is it going to operate?
You know, it's a little bit murky now. The best that we've been able to determine by asking LAFCO where it goes from here is that they're going to need to divide up the territory into nine zones and have nine districts and try to find candidates to run for the board from nine individual districts. This is new. I hadn't heard this. When the ballot went out this year's, you know, the second attempt, there was a choice of 11 candidates for nine board positions, and they were all at large positions. And naturally, those posts were all elected by the highest voting value of land, just like the highest voting value of land established the district. Is it a Butte County entity? No, it's a sort of a semi. It's a regulated California water district.
So it's quasi. It's kind of quasi government.
It is. It is. It is. And it's. Hmm. It has the ability to levy taxes. It has eminent domain.
How can a non government entity levy a tax?
Well, good question, but there's all the way back in 2017, we have a document that was put together by a legal scholar at UC Berkeley, just pointing out that the State Groundwater Management Act of 2014 that set us on the path towards all these exotic new government entities claiming to be there to make the groundwater sustainable and levying new taxes to do so, it's kind of created a free-for-all with new government lists all over the state. A lot of them are hybrids of publicly elected and privately appointed boards. You have companies being able to vote. You have counties like Butte County just didn't want to be involved in the groundwater sustainability business. Not sure why. We have a very good Department of Water Conservation here, very professional. But it was stated on the dais at the Board of Supervisors many times right in front of me that, oh, we don't have the money to think about groundwater sustainability. Well, rather than figure out how to come up with the money and manage sustainability for Butte County, they've spun off groundwater sustainability into a whole bunch of little groundwater sustainability agencies, which are quasi-democratic. They're sort of democratic, but really they're dominated by the growers, the pumpers. I'm not arguing with that. I mean, they're very interested in the health of the groundwater. That just doesn't mean that there's anything nefarious right in that. But the devil is in the details. And when you set up all these entities and they're not quite transparent enough, and there's two or three steps away from an actual elected official being held accountable at election time, it just doesn't look like it's really doing very much, certainly not in the short term, for an aquifer that is being damaged. It is being overdrawn. And one of our main objections in the Tustin Water District has been, well, do you think they're pretending to do something about sustainability or taking advantage of an apparent crisis or a real crisis to put something in place that is practically guaranteed to result in a corporate takeover of groundwater supplies and backdoor shenanigans having to do with laundering the water and selling it onward. And
they're already doing groundwater recharge. And once they pump enough of their surface water down there, the surface water that they technically own, they can claim ownership over the water in the aquifer.
Yeah, and we've seen adequate paper trail all over the place in the documents earlier on in all of these processes. They will come right out and say in the reports or in the, you know, state documents, and in the end, we'll be able to move water around the state and have a flexible market. And which, if you're a state water planner, that makes perfect sense. But if for people here who are seeing their homes well go dry and have to sink tens of thousands of dollars in a hole that they don't have,
well, they're gonna have to purchase water from the water district once their shallow well goes dry.
No, the option is to just drill deeper, and that is a very, very expensive thing to do.
To get all the way into the Tuscan aquifer, you've got to go pretty deep.
And the point being, our public agencies and elected officials, their responsibility, as far as I'm concerned, is to prevent the water table from sinking any further. That anything other than that is going to be very, very unwelcome to hear about. But I have not, the thrust of everybody's attitude in the county government, the water department, it has seemed from the beginning to be, how do we keep the farmers happy? And B, oh, it's inevitable that the groundwater is going to sink because, oh, well, you know, we're not getting, it's not raining like it used to. So how are we going to mitigate the damage? And I, as far as I'm concerned, preventing any further damage should be what they're expected to do and what they do.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes. And there's been a whole lot of this sort of knee-jerk response to, oh, well, the worst thing that could happen is the state of California comes in and decides that we're not sustaining the groundwater, and they come in here and slap meters on everybody's wells. And at some point, I realized that, to me, is not the worst outcome to this situation at all. If I have to spend a few hundred dollars a year, you know, to our the majestically profligate state of California to come in and actually regulate so that there's no further damage done to an aquifer that is priceless and that is the fulcrum of our longevity in this area as a community, well, that would not be the worst thing to happen. The worst thing that can happen is if the water levels keep on deteriorating, we get socked with another really bad drought. And then with this water district in place and these other new layers of government, the groundwater sustainability agencies, they have all, they have mechanisms in place to really start to do damage or to really abandon the homeowner. And or to say, oh, we're going to be so nice. We're going to, you know, we're going to truck in some free water for you so you can take a shower. This is already what's happening down in the San Joaquin Valley.
Right.
In places
right.
that are running out of their groundwater.
So yeah, we're already
I don't
seeing...
want to hear about, oh, we'll, you know, we'll do some nice after the fact sort of, you know, county water welfare for you if your well goes dry. I don't want to hear that. I want to hear that they are not going to let the groundwater deteriorate any further. And the way to do that is not to set up taxing and spending mechanisms to continue enabling the people who are doing the people and firms that are doing the damage by overpumping, overplanting, not being realistic, transferring the cost of their excessive activity onto the taxpayer and onto the rest of the community. And in the case of the Tuscan Water District, without the rest of the community having any say over it, it's not democratic, and therefore it's not acceptable. And that in a nutshell is why I got involved and why we put forth this effort. And did we change the election outcome? No. I mean, people were asking me, Jeff, what can we do? And I was being thumped on the radio saying, gosh, you know, there's not a whole lot we can do.
Yeah.
It's a rigged election from the get-go.
Right.
But I learned in time to
say, because it's a water grab.
No,
that's why it's a rigged
get involved,
election.
Pay attention, show up at some of these, any of these water meetings. And if they know that the community is watching, that is already something. That's quite a lot already.
Yeah, I mean, so what would be, we're kind of running up on time here. I only got about
okay.
a minute or so left with you. So now that it's formed, you said there's going to be a vote next year on a tax, a proportionate tax to your property tax to help start funding this?
The original proposal in the first election, which was canceled, was $10 per acre. If I believe that was going to accomplish groundwater sustainability, I'd be happy to pay.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it to me.
Well, who knows? But if it's anyway, they are required to have this second election under the terms of the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they will even need the money is an open question, because there's grant money flowing from Sacramento. And even from maybe even from the federal government, because groundwater sustainability is becoming a nationwide hue and cry. You may have noticed it's
right.
in the big newspapers now.
Uh-huh.
It's a crisis all over the place. But they may get grant money from the state to say, okay, now that you've established your water district, you know, here's a few mil, and knock yourselves out, you know, implement some projects.
Some of the
projects they want to implement will be well worth doing.
So
it's again, the devil in the details.
Right.
What are they going to do with transferring water if they are up and running as a California water district and California comes knocking? We don't know the answer to that. We've never really gotten a whole lot of straight talk out of the proponents of this, and we fear the worst, and we're just warning the community about it. How can people pay attention? Well, look at what they just did shutting down Valley's Edge, which, by the way, is a triumph for the aquifer, because that land is where the water seeps in.
It's part of it. It's part of it.
Yeah, part of it. Mm-hmm. Part of it is percolation into volcanic rock.
That Tuscan shelf goes way further south, but yeah, it goes out toward Durham.
But I think that was an example of how an organized community effort made a difference. We would need to have a good organized community effort to try and, from this point on, to try and strangle the Tuscan Water District in its crib. It would either take that, or it's going to take some kind of a lawsuit, which I personally have no intention of generating myself.
I need to get Jim Brobeck back on here and talk about what Aqua Alliance is getting ready to do about this, because it everything I understand about it, it just sounds like a big water grab, and they just want to integrate one of the largest aquifers in the North State into their water transferring scheme. So,
yeah, and sort of provide cover for that with these supposed recharge activities and infrastructure,
which can never keep up with the amount that they pump out versus what they imagine they'll be able to artificially recharge with versus how nature recharges them. It'll never keep up.
No, everything that I've read. They don't know. That's the other thing. And Jim Brobeck will fill you in. The science isn't there.
Right.
They're going on non-existent science, and they're making a lot of leaps of faith.
Mm-hmm.
Taking the gamble that you're taking is far too big if it's the future of the groundwater underneath here. So, I would call on all of people who care about the water situation to just pay attention to this.
Yeah,
it's so under the radar for so many people because it's very arcane and I think that it should be insisted upon that everybody in Butte County vote on this. On this ground.
Yeah, you can't. Yeah, because the Tuscan water, the Tuscan aquifer is much bigger than the boundaries of the district that they're drains shallow aquifers. All the shallow aquifers above it get affected by the depressurization of the lower Tuscan aquifer, and so there's a lot of hydrology to it that is going to affect a lot more people than just people within that boundary. Anyways, people can stay more informed by checking out your website, Jeff, groundwaterforbutte.com, or is that .org?
No, it's .org, and the word "for" is spelled out. It's not the numeral. And, for our side of the story, there's a very complete website, and we're gonna do the next thing I'm going to publish on it is that just a little critique of the groundwater recharge plan that the county just passed. Good intentions. Maybe some of it will work, but there's some real pie in the sky wishful thinking in that document, and I'm going to go through that.
I gotta cut you off here. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, thanks for coming on, and people can, like I said, keep updated on groundwaterforbutte.org.
And I'd highly recommend that people show up at a groundwater sustainability agency.
And that's another way to keep informed is go to the meetings. Do you list the meetings on your website?
I just launched a calendar. Yeah, there's an action calendar, and it's populated with whatever meetings are coming up. And the next one is, I believe, March 13th.
All right. Well, there you go, folks. There you go, folks. You can hit the groundwaterforbutte.org and see the calendar of meetings that you can go to and get your voice heard on this water district. Thanks a lot, Jeff, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me, Ron. Take care.
Bye. And that was Jeff Obser from Groundwater for Butte. And you can find out more information about the Tuscan Water District and the Tuscan Aquifer by going to groundwaterforbutte.org and find out how you can help affect some kind of change in the way that this water district is going to operate, because all the other big water districts around the state operate pretty much like Jeff described, as a quasi government entity that can tax you if you're a landowner within the district and not be very transparent with what they're doing with the water. And the next guest on my show, I'm gonna have to get Lindsay Wood on the phone, and while I call her up, enjoy this song by Dana Lyons called Sometime.
When you feel the ground rumbling, when you hear the great horn sound, The big steel wheels are grinding, the three lights bearing down. When a sound that once seemed friendly now is tearing at your heart, there's no backing down. Sometimes the people stand up for a reason. When you see the long train coming, and it's coming to your town, and it's carrying the poison in 100,000 cars, and you hear your daughter coughing when it wakes her in the night, there's no backing down. When you know it drops the value of every home in town, when you know the kids with asthma jumping rope on the playground, when you know we're all against it and our voices do not count, there's no backing down. Sometimes the people stand up for a reason. Sometimes the people stand up for a reason. When they hit you with the sales pitch, while they're buying off the state, while the feds are gonna tell you that the towns don't have the rights to block interstate commerce, to protect your family's health, there's no backing down. In Billings, down through to Bellingham, when every doc and teacher, when every mayor stands, when every child who...
And that was Dana Lyons with Sometimes the Coal Train Song. Welcome back. You are listening to KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And this is your North State Water Report. And coming up next, I have Lindsay Wood on the line. And we're going to be talking about, on Sunday, February 11th, a train car or a train hauling coal through the Feather River Canyon derailed and sent 15 cars full of coal tumbling into the Middle Fork of the Feather River. There have been decades of derailments up and down the Feather River Canyon. And here to talk about all of this tonight is Lindsay Wood. Lindsay is a longtime resident of Butte County. Lindsay has spent most of her career working to protect our watersheds and forests. And Lindsay, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Ron. Thanks for having
me
on.
Yeah, welcome to the show. I know you're not feeling good, so thanks for sticking with it and coming on tonight.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So, coal trains going through the Feather River Canyon. Not so smart, is it?
I think actually this most recent derailment occurred kind of outside of Portola, so at least that wasn't a really steep canyon area like the North Fork Canyon area. I wanted to give folks a bit of history of what we've done on this issue. I remember back in 2016, in the aftermath of Lac-Mégantic rail disaster, which happened in Quebec, our local environmental group became concerned about trains moving hazardous material through the Feather River Canyon. For those that aren't familiar with the Lac-Mégantic rail disaster, 73 cars carrying Bakken crude oil derailed, and the explosion killed 47 people. So we have oil and other hazardous material that moves through the Feather River Canyon quite often, actually. And so we became concerned about that. In 2014, there was a spill in the North Fork Feather Canyon of corn. A couple of years before that, there was some fuel. And even a couple of years ago, I think in 2018 or 19, there was another fuel spill. And so in my role at that time on the Forest Advisory Committee, we ended up sending a letter to the United States Department of Transportation. We requested two things. We were requesting rerouting hazardous or trains carrying hazardous material, maybe through a different route that wasn't quite so densely forested. And another thing that we requested was an upgrade of rail car requirements moving through that. So kind of fast forward to what we saw a couple of weeks ago was another derailment, this time containing coal. These rail cars were open. The coal discharged directly into the Middle Fork of the river, which most folks will know as the Wild and Scenic Feather River. But one thing I'm not hearing spoken about very much is the nature of the reaction of coal in water. And, you know, Ron and I, you and I have talked about just that a little bit.
It seems like they're, it's not getting a lot of press. I mean, there was a little bit of news when it first happened, but we haven't heard anything in the news about any kind of cleanup or anything like that going on.
Yeah, I read in the SACB article that they had an estimate of $150,000 cleanup price tag, but we haven't, like you said, heard very much. One thing that CDFW was quoted in that SACB article saying is that they weren't anticipating any environmental impact. But I just wanted to talk about the nature of coal immersed in water, the chemistry of what happens when all the oxygen in the river suddenly acts as an electron receptor and absorbs through the coal. This type of thing causes deoxygenation in the river, as well as it starts creating pores within the coal itself. And, you know, the oxidation pathways of coal aren't fully understood by scientists right now. But what the literature suggests is that moisture content is the most influential factor of spontaneous combustion of coal, and that long-term immersion leads to, like I said, increased pore structure as well as the likelihood of combustion. I guess in reading different literature based on coal entering into the water, what I took away is that when the immersion time reaches about 60 days, that is when the oxidation is the highest of coal and spontaneous combustion becomes most likely. I think about 60 days from that spill is sometime in April. And I just think that folks should be aware. I think it's valuable to have situational awareness when we have a combustible discharge into rivers nearby.
Yeah, I mean, what other kind of train cars do they move through there? Are they moving oil trains through that corridor as well?
I am not exactly sure what types of hazardous materials, but if you take an afternoon, you drive up Highway 70, you will see train cars, and they will have those signs on them saying hazardous material. I am pretty certain that they also move oil through the canyon as well, but I'm not sure the quantity. But I think what we were suggesting in our Forest Advisory Committee letter is really that we should upgrade the types of rail cars we are allowing to move through those areas to make it more safe, because it does seem like that might be a necessary route for a lot of goods.
Yeah, it seems like a lot of what we do in the country as a whole, but largely here in California, when it comes to water and the infrastructure, all the dams, all these power dams, all the reservoir dams, and then you see these railway corridors that are contaminating rivers because they're so close. I mean, there was a huge Superfund cleanup site in Dunsmuir, the Dunsmuir rail yard, in the last year and a half or so, where at the rail yard, oil seeped into the upper Sacramento there, up above the reservoir, and it's been a huge cleanup project up there. So it just seems like everything's so antiquated, and we just keep using it, and nothing, these disasters, these spills and whatnot just keep getting worse and worse.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. I would like to see greater protection of water resources, especially for those waters that we've already designated to protect. The Middle Fork Feather River is already designated as wild and scenic. And of course, the North Fork Feather River, these are rivers that drain directly to Lake Orville. That's the state water project. That's right. Where California gets a lot of water from. It's pretty important that we don't contaminate those waters.
Right, right. Yeah, you got to wonder how much. I mean, how do they, do you have any idea how they clean that up? Do they just put booms in the river and try to scoop off as much as they can?
That's my guess. I'm not certain that they would be able to get 100% of it, but coal is definitely less dense in water, so I anticipate it would float. Mm-hmm. So you'd probably be able to clean it up using booms. But then again, some areas of the Middle Fork, depending how far down it went, it is pretty remote and steep to get equipment back there, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, this time of year, the water is moving so fast through there. I'm sure it carried that coal pretty quick.
Yeah, and, you know, that's actually one benefit. Because there is so much water, there's probably a lot more turbidity than there would otherwise be. And so because of that, less oxygen, less chance to oxidize the coal. So maybe these reactions will take place over a longer period of time, give folks more time to get that cleanup taken care of. I was reading in this article that it's actually 118 tons of coal per rail car.
And there were 14 or 15 cars tumbled into the river, too.
Yeah, and I don't think the entire contents of all 14 cars tumbled in, but that's still a significant amount of coal. That's really quite a bit.
Yeah, it's a lot of coal. I mean, I did a little bit of reading after that of like what coal can do in water and other parts of the country where they have constant problems from coal, and mostly from coal mines, mm-hmm. where they pump off the water into these retention ponds, and then those retention ponds either get into the groundwater or it contaminates people's drinking water. And they have all kinds of problems in these towns that are around coal mines. So, yeah, it's not good to have coal mixing in your water.
No, it's not. And, you know, if I could kind of shift gears here, Ron, another thing maybe not so great to have in your water, heavy metals. I wanted to take the chance, since I'm on air here with you, to let people know about the Moonlight Copper Mine. For those that are not aware, the Moonlight deposit is up in Plumas County along the tributaries of White Creek, which is a tributary to Indian Creek. And there is a proposed 1.3 billion pound copper mine along White National Forest, or private land in holdings in Plumas National Forest, rather. And I just wanted to throw out there, you know, another copper mine site that I've studied for remediation. Soils show elevated levels of lead, arsenic, selenium, of course, copper. Some other contaminants related to mining of copper include benzene, naphthalene, diesel. And so all these issues are really affecting the headwaters of the Feather River. This is where we get our drinking water from.
Indian Creek drains into the Feather River, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, well, yeah, I know they have big battles over mines up in Alaska, too, on all of the wild and scenic rivers up there and all the salmon rivers up there. And
yeah, I was talking to a friend about this Moonlight copper mine, actually, and we were talking about that because, you know, a big mine like Bristol Bay, that Pebble copper mine was defeated. The EPA decided against it last year. I think that they're looking for other sources of copper now, and that kind of puts some of our water resources in the lower 48 at risk as well.
Yeah. I'm going to do a little research myself before my next show and find out, see if I can get some information on how this cleanup is going of this coal, and hopefully have an update for folks next month. And how could listeners find out more about this Moonlight Copper Mine?
You know, I think you can just Google it. It's Moonlight-Superior Copper Mine. The environmental reports are by Tetra Tech. They're out there. The project proponent is the U.S. Copper Company. I think it's just basic company name. But yeah, just give it a Google.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds like an important one to also keep up on, and glad we have folks like you on these forest advisory committees doing the research as well, Lindsay. I know every time I see you and we talk, I learn something new.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. Thanks again, Ron.
Yeah. Again, you've been listening to Lindsay Wood, and Lindsay is... What is the forest committee you're on?
Oh, that's an old committee. I was telling a story from 2015. It's called the Forest Advisory Committee.
Hmm. Okay. Anyways, we've been talking with Lindsay Wood, who is a longtime Butte County resident, what is your background? Why don't you give our listeners a little bit of your education and background?
Oh, sure. Yeah. My background is mostly in wildlife biology, but I've really transitioned into environmental sciences. I typically work at the confluence of wildlife and how water policy affects wildlife populations. I've been doing that in California and more recently in Alaska as well. I'm happy to be supporting mostly indigenous tribes through my work right now. So it's really lovely to be able to work on environmental issues and watersheds that I care about.
All right. Thank you so much, Lindsay, for coming on tonight. And we are just about out of time. And you have yourself a good evening, and we'll talk again soon, Lindsay.
All right. Cheers. Bye now.
Bye. Okay, we got one more little bit of radio station information here. The North State Water Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by D.A. Lampe Construction, a proud supporter of KZFR and community radio in Northern California. For more information, visit dalampeconstruction.com. And by Mountain Sports, providing outdoor clothing and equipment for hiking, backpacking, camping, traveling, and enjoying the great outdoors. Mountain Sports is open Monday through Saturday from 10 a.m. till 5:30 p.m. at 176 East 3rd Street in downtown Chico, serving Chico and the North State since 1975. And you have been listening to the monthly North State Water Report. My name is Ron Topi, and this is 90.1 FM KZFR Community Radio for the Sacramento Valley, the foothills, and beyond. And I'm going to let you go tonight with a song by Lila June called Water is Life.
He said it's not a song, it's a way of life. It's a forever thing, it's a message. He said you can say that water is
is life. You can sing it again and again, but will they listen? Are we gonna stand by these words? Are we gonna find a way to change the way we're living, Mother Earth? She feels everything and it hurts. Like the moon, like the body of a woman, she's changing. Can we return to the times when water was alive, when we prayed at her edge and gave thanks for this life? When the water fell from the sky and we drank from her bosom, when the water fell from our eyes and the water fell from our womb, when it rose up to the surface and we knew every spring, no fear of competition, just a relative to a phase. We are people of the sun, we are people of the water. We will celebrate our sons, we will celebrate our daughters. Give them ceremony so when the drought comes, they'll be ready. Will the next war be for water? All our solutions are part of the problem. Can't win war with war. There is more than one creation story. Worlds have died and worlds have been reborn before. When you touch the water, you touch the world. From peaks to Gulf Streams, the memories they hold. We sell her by the acre foot and treat her as our captive. The rivers are undrinkable while the aquifer's extracted. Our food will need water to grow, but do you have to take it all? We try to hold her and control her as we watch our empire fall. He said it's not a song, it's a way of life, it's a forever thing, it's a message. He said you can say that water is life, you can sing it again and again, but can you live it?
Watching, hoping, praying that this time it becomes fallen, as done by their grandmothers, grandfathers, long ago, when they spoke with animals, their smoke still floating, touching the morning prayers. Grandfathers, grandmothers, sons and daughters, me, us, the mountains and animals, covered with the morning pollen.
You're listening to FM 90.1 KZFR Chico, listener-supported community radio for the Sacramento Valley.
Scientists find evidence of geothermal activity on icy dwarfs Eris and Makemake. This week on Planetary Radio. I'm Sarah Al-Ahmed of the Planetary Society, with more of the human adventure across our solar system and beyond. A team co-led by the Southwest Research Institute has discovered signs of hydrothermal and metamorphic activity within the icy dwarfs Eris and Makemake in the Kuiper Belt. The lead author on this research, Chris Glein, joins us today to explain. But first, we have an exciting update from the world of U.S. space politics with our Chief of Space Policy, Casey Dreyer, and our Director of Government Relations, Jack Kirley. We'll also take a moment to celebrate the touchdown of the Intuitive Machines Odysseus Lunar Lander with our senior communications advisor, Matt Kaplan. Hang out until the end for What's Up with Bruce Betts and a new random space fact. If you love Planetary Radio and want to stay informed about the latest space discoveries, make sure you hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcasting platform.